Athletes, take your mark and get set. It's time for the Addict to Athlete podcast. Everybody out there, Coach Blue Robinson here. I want to give you all a special thanks and shout out for downloading, subscribing, and sharing this podcast to anyone who may be struggling with addictions, mental health. Get it into the ears of those who truly need this. We hope you can use this as a platform for a little bit more of information to get some dialogue going within your families if anyone needs help. Please check out our website, addict2athlete.org. Lots of resources, lots of things on there, current events, all the stuff that you'll need to get more information about how Team Addict to Athlete works. I couldn't start the show without thanking our Patreon subscribers. Thank you so much for your willingness to support Team Addict to Athlete in pushing our podcast and some of our efforts forward. Our super fans, Jerem Thurston, Holly Davies, Scott Foster, Coach Chris Williams, Brett Frew, Coach Tara Butson, and the Warrior Within podcast and personal development by Sensei KP. Our rookie levels, Josh Hansen, Kenny Roseman, Earl Dyer, and Joe Jackson. Not to mention the pro levels, Selena Armitage and Gary Thurston, and our championship level subscribers, Shad and Freya Robison and the Robison family, Ron and D. Loesch and Tracy Whitby. Thank you, Patreon subscribers. If you'd like to jump on and get some bonus content, patreon.com/addict2athlete. Listeners, I'm excited today. Another referral from our friend Randy Grimes. I think that Randy gets us some amazing guests, and I got to thank him profusely for this one, because today we get to talk with a guy who's really, I think, turned from athlete to some addiction to Iron Man. And we're going to speak with Corey Harrington today. Corey, thank you so much, brother, for spending some time with us. You have a history in Major League Baseball, and there's some other, I guess, things that put yourself into a position where you are actually called an Iron Man. So you've got an amazing story. I've done some research on you. But would you mind sharing with the athletes, these listeners, a little bit about yourself, maybe about, you know, your professional baseball career, getting into some of the after, you know, situations with addiction. Yeah. And then I want to jump into your Iron Man feats, because that's, I think, where you really start competing against yourself. I think the foundation of recovery, moving from addict to Iron Man, I mean, I don't think there's anything more great that can be accomplished, but we'll see. Corey, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, yeah, I appreciate it. Thing is, I never made it to the big league, so I don't want to go on here and promote that I played in the big league. Yeah. I was a minor leaguer, so
minor leaguers are the same in my eyes, man. Yeah. Brilliant.
I get it, but I just wanted to say that off the bat. We currently live, my wife and my two kids, they're 6 and 4. We live in the Seattle area. We are originally both from Lincoln, Nebraska. And, you know, I grew up as an athlete, you know, football, basketball, baseball growing up. And I was straight as an arrow. Sports were my thing. They were my life. And, you know, the good part of it is sports are great. The bad part is when you start to find your value and your identity solely in that. And I got to that point. So growing up, yeah, play all these sports, and I excelled mostly in baseball. So I took a scholarship, played baseball in college. I was drafted by the Seattle Mariners, played a few years in their minor league system. And and then I was released, got married, yeah. and regretted the fact that I didn't give it a shot to continue my dream. I had some opportunities to sign on with some other clubs. I was bitter. I was immature. I was 22 years old.
22. And,
I didn't necessarily know how to handle that. But I then got back in and I started playing independent baseball, which is basically a step. It's a minor leagues, but it's not affiliated with an organization. And so I was working my butt off to try and make my dream a reality again. And that's kind of like the spot where this all starts, because I have an injury happen that leads me down this path of 10 years of struggling with opioids and in really dark and secretive places where nobody else knew about it. So
that was kind of the gate opener was injury that got you started there.
You know, throughout my career in college, I had a couple of surgeries, medication was just medication then. Right. I never knew the difference between an opioid, a Tylenol, or ibuprofen. It was just what you took because you were told you needed this for, you know, getting through whatever it is you're going through. Mm-hmm. In the late stages of my career when I'm 26 years old and I'm playing independent ball and I dislocate my shoulder at the plate one night. That all changed. I think that, well, first off, I'm not a home run hitter. I'll just tell you this, because this is pretty cool. This is a pretty cool aspect of it, is I don't hit home runs. But that night I'm at the plate, I swing, my shoulder dislocates, but I make contact with the ball and I fall over in the batter's box.
Oh, man.
I get up because I'm told to get up because the ball leaves the park. So I hit a home run, dislocate my shoulder, and end up walking around the bases with my shoulder being held by my other arm. And so as amazing as it is to hit a home run and that feeling, man, the despair and the understanding of what that meant for my career really hit home in that moment. So
As you're rounding the bases, you're thinking, this is going to change everything when I hit that home plate. Yeah.
Yeah. Like this is at this stage in my career, a shoulder surgery is pretty much the nail in the coffin. Right. So I have that going through my head and I walk into the locker room and a teammate's doing nothing but trying to help me. This man, you're going to be in some pain. This will probably help. Didn't know what it was, but I took it. And that pill, that opiate, that I don't even know what it was, the Percocet or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, within the hour, my shoulder felt okay.
Like, and I don't care if I have shoulders now. Like, this is fine.
If in an hour and a half, the sinking feeling in my heart, the depression of like, what does this mean for my career? Like those feelings that I was feeling, those kind of dark things, they were lifted too. It masked it all in a matter of an hour and a half. Right. And so that was the moment that I realized that these pills could do more than just mask that pain, that physical pain.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was kind of like really like an eye opener too. It's like, not only do I not feel the pain, but all the disappointment, all the worry, all the concern, it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, man.
Completely masks it. Right. And looking back, that was 13 years ago now, just over 13 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was the moment that this 10-year struggle started. And it's kind of crazy to look back and I can vividly just remember it. So
does it seem like a whole nother lifestyle though? Like a whole nother like chapter? I mean, it's probably that was wild.
You know, Blue, I think that we probably, anybody in recovery feels this, this sense of like, you can remember that person. And sometimes it feels like yesterday. And yet sometimes it feels like a lifetime ago.
Right.
That it's hard to remember that person, yet, man, that person will never go away because that person was the reason that I'm where I am now.
And, absolutely. Are kind of coming off the cusp of all this kind of stuff. You said kind of to a certain degree, recently married, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Tell me about that. Like, I mean, from the podcast I heard, it seems like you kept this under wraps for a really long time. And that had to have been hell in and of itself, Corey. I can only imagine.
Well, so, you know, a couple things is one is, I always like to say everybody's story is different, man. We got a lot of things in similarities, but there's a lot of differences too. And some people's path and progression on addiction and abuse is quick, and some is very slow. And mine happened to be slow. And I say that because that pill, you know, it opened my eyes to something.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as if I had access to opioids. It wasn't as if, like, you know, you can just go to the bar like you can if you want to drink, right?
Exactly.
And so it's kind of a series of unfortunate events from that moment on. I play the rest of the season and I take Celebrex. I was given Celebrex by a doctor, and Celebrex is, I don't want to speak to it because I don't know exactly what it is, whether it's a very low dose narcotic or something, but it allowed me to play through the pain through that season.
Kind of common, right? With athletes.
It's very common, right? And sadly, it's one of those things that it's not always on the up and up, right? I mean, there's money behind things. There's reasons that they want you on the field, and they will give you what you need to continue to stay on the field. And that's minor league baseball, right? I mean, you can imagine what it's like when you get to the big leagues or the NFL and things like that, right? There's so much more money tied up in it. But even at my level, I experienced it. And at the end of that season, I had a surgery to fix my shoulder, which I played through the rest of that season. Then I had surgery to fix it. And my wife and I are just moved to Minnesota in the off season. I have surgery. It's winter in Minnesota, which is miserable already. The sun's setting at 4 o'clock. You know, I just got done with surgery. My wife is working to help pay the bills. I have no income. And it's just a really dark place, right? I'm sitting there, basically juggling the fact that I'm going to try and go back next season and play, but I don't have a good feeling about how this is going to happen. And not knowing what the next step is. And also so much of my identity was tied up in being a baseball player. And my value was found on a day in and day out basis of how I did at the plate. If I had a good game, I felt good about myself. If I didn't, I felt bad. It was just a roller coaster of how I felt about myself, which is
all kind of pivoted on those premise. Yeah.
I mean, how unhealthy is that, right? To find your value based just in that.
Makes sense. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I'm sitting in Minnesota and I have a prescription because I just got done with surgery and I'm taking them as prescribed, yet they're making me feel the way I remembered them making me feel. And I could kind of check out a reality. Yeah. And from there, man, I get asked quite often, like, well, how do you have access to these? Like, you know, how do you have access to pills if that's your drug? Like, how does that happen? And as I mentioned, a series of unfortunate events, well, there's choices that you make too. I mean, you always hear, you know, the commercials, you know, lock up your medications and this and that. Like I started to steal from my friends, my family, from strangers. I think we all go through this phase of like, do I have a problem? Can I normalize this? Am I okay? I'm not as bad as the next guy or what I see on the street. Or I always thought that my examples of people who are struggling was like the Brett Favre, who had a team of people to help him. It was very public and it didn't seem like a huge shame and guilt spiral. It was like, hey, this is what happened to me. I got help and now I'm back on the field. Or the example of, hey, there's a guy that overdosed in the street and is an addict, like we would like to say, and he just died of an overdose. Well, man, I'm not either of those guys. I'm somewhere in the gray in between.
Yeah, you're in the gray.
The middle area. Mm-hmm. And as time went on, I had the next season started and we're starting our season down in Florida. And before the first game of the season, I go in to take a piss before I go out to the field. And what do you know? I'm a kidney stone just out of the blue. Yeah. I get sent to the ER. What happens? I get prescribed more painkillers.
Yeah.
So like this progression of unfortunate events just keeps going.
Keep prolonging.
Right. They keeps giving me access in a way that I wouldn't have. Like you can't just get these things. I mean, I'm sure that's a lie. I'm sure you can buy them off the street. I never went that route.
I'm sure
I never
got them. But without you knowing what corner to go to or what dealers, you know, legit and all this. Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's that series of unfortunate events, which rightly so. I've had a kidney stone, man. I'm like, give me something to get rid of this. But it makes a lot of sense back to back to back with that constant golden thread of, I still feel like I did that time where nothing mattered. And I'm a firm believer, Corey, that, you know, I've been doing addiction recovery for 20 years as a therapist and counselor. And I've kind of noticed a few things. I think that people use for one of two reasons. One is just to have the party, to have the experience, just to push the envelope, see how far they could, you know, ride the pony, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The second one is to cover pain, whether it's emotional, physical, spiritual, something else that hurts. So I can only imagine through some of the physical stuff you're going through, there's also some emotional pain and some spiritual pain, all this kind of stuff. And opiates, you're right, takes care of all of that. So when you're constantly prescribed those things, you're just like, I'm in a constant state of just like, you know, existing. I can only imagine that. So kidney stones, more opiates then.
Yeah. Then a couple months later, I am wakeboarding and I hurt my back and I have a herniated disc, right? So now I have sciatica issues. And man, if that wasn't like the opening of the door for how this took a bad turn, right? Mm-hmm. I say that that injury became the crutch and my lifeline to be able to get these drugs basically anytime that I wanted to.
Right.
Because I think that a back issue like that, it's so hard to diagnose. I mean, I had a herniated disc, so boom, I have proof that I need something. And now I would use that to go into a clinic and say, man, I'm having a sciatica issue. Like, can you please prescribe me, you know, this? And it would be done, right? Because I have a history of it now. Like I have
a golden ticket, right? You've got your golden ticket there.
And you think that, right? Like you're in this phase of thinking that, like, A, crazy enough is you can continue to normalize things and say you don't have a problem. You don't have a problem. And you can do that by getting online and taking like the quizzes and like checking the boxes. Like, have I lost my job? No. Have I lost my wife? No. Have I ruined my relationships? I haven't.
Man, so you bring up a good point, because that's that part. And don't get me wrong, I love the 12 steps and whatnot. Addict Athlete's not a 12-step program, but your life becomes unmanageable. But what if your life doesn't come unmanageable? What if only certain aspects of it get kind of rusty and kind of suck? But the rest of it, you can totally balance. That's like you said, you're in the gray. It's not like your whole life has collapsed. It's just like, you know, things are still working out. That's got to be hard to put yourself in a mindset of where do I fit?
You can keep the tent poles up, right? You can keep it afloat, but the thing that's drowning, the thing that's dying is yourself. Like you can keep all that other stuff up and like nobody knows about it. And I did such a good job of hiding it. One, because they're pills. You can hide them fairly easily. It's not like a bottle of booze.
Pretty
it's a
simple.
Little harder and there's a smell involved and all those things. Like you can be, you know, pretty lucid and still be high and nobody knows about it, right? So it can be hidden pretty easily. And so, you know, that, and then it goes back to the fact that, man, to everybody who knew me growing up, Corey Herring could not possibly be the guy who has this issue. So even if there was an inkling of like a, man, he seemed funny today or something like that, it never went to a point of somebody would ask me or even my wife, for God's sakes, like she knows me better than anybody. And I could hide this from her, right? Because to that same point, she knows me as the guy that she knew about in high school and in college, right? Like that never, this would have never been him. And that secret, you know, starts to destroy you. Like it starts to destroy me. I can't look myself in the mirror anymore. Like that person is all I can see is the person wrapped up in that shame spiral. And that becomes who I see. I don't see any of the good anymore. I just see that's the thing that I see in the mirror. And I hit it for a decade and things progress, right? Like it started out as taking pills because, hey, it helped me not feel the things I didn't want to feel, right? The things that I hadn't worked through, the things I hadn't gone to therapy. I mean, I'm kind of all over the place here, but I want to go back to it because this is as an athlete, you know, there's so many things in life that you're expected to, or it's okay to get a coach for. If you're an athlete, you're coached from the day you start playing sports, and nothing but good comes from getting a coach, right? Like, absolutely. I mean, there's bad experiences here and there, right? But overall, you get a coach because you want to get better. You want somebody to help you and coach you along. Well, I look back on the fact that, you know, so much of baseball, so much of sports, but so much of baseball is mental. It's a huge mental game. You hear about guys getting the yips and everything else, the Chuck Knoblauchs of the world, guys can't throw it back to the pitcher, all these things. Like, that's a mental block. There's nothing physical there. And yet it is taboo to think that you need a coach to help you with the mental side of things. And that goes from sports to therapy in your own life, right? The things 100%. That like, you're seen as weak if you need to go to therapy. Like, you're seen as weak. And yet every other aspect of our lives, getting a coach means like, man, you're taking it to the next level.
Yeah.
But it's completely backwards idea with it.
Especially with the male mentality that we all have too. As alpha males, we're like, we don't need help with that. We can deal with it. Yeah. You're speaking the truth. I got you.
Exactly. So, so over time, Blue, like this just started to progress. And I can say like the moment you look at the mirror and you say like, I stole narcotics, like that's a felony. And no, like that should be pretty eye-opening for somebody to be like, okay, this has gotten out of control the moment you start stealing drugs and narcotics. And yet I would just keep saying I'm okay because I would quit here and there. I mean, I would quit for a month, 2 months at a time. And then it would creep back in like this, what am I trying to mask? When I got done with baseball, I lost my identity. I lost my value. And right at that point as well, my wife went back to school to get her master's degree. And my wife is a badass when it comes to setting goals. And when she wants to do something, she does it.
Well, I have one like that too.
That took all of her time and everything went into that. And it just so happened that it was coincidental at the same time when I am like at a loss and kind of spiraling, who am I? What am I about? Right. And my wife is all of a sudden, you know, very much all of her time and energy is going to this huge goal she has. And I'm sitting here going, you know, so I don't say selfishly, but more just like was that what she was attracted to? Was now that I'm not a baseball player and I don't have this possibility of making it to the big leagues, like, have I let her down too? I feel like I've let everybody else, including myself. But now I'm like, we're kind of struggling, and I don't, man. And I
can
like,
only
man,
imagine that mindset too, brother, because that addiction also kind of puts us into those paradigms of believing these lies that we create to justify how we feel. And so convincing yourself of that, I'm sure seemed very real, because you're right. That addiction gets whispering in there and starts trying to convince you that you're not who you think you are. That is its own private hell in and of itself, I would imagine.
Yeah, other side of things, like I say that I think that keeping super promises has become like my superpower. Yeah. Keeping promises is my superpower. Well, because what keeping promises does for me on a daily basis is it rebuilds my self-confidence. Like mm-hmm. what I had lost during that 10 years of my life, my confidence, like keeping promises daily is what has rebuilt that confidence. But as I look back on that 10 years, every day that I said I wasn't going to take a pill and I did, I was breaking a promise to myself every day. So it just continued to destroy my self-confidence. I mm-hmm. went from this guy who was so confident because I was achieving at a high level in professional baseball to all of a sudden, like it just started to nosedive, because every time that I would take one of those pills, I was breaking my self-confidence.
Yeah.
And it took me, it takes anybody. It takes you to dark places where you don't think you're deserving of things. You don't know who you are anymore. You're like, what is that person that I used to be? Is he even there anymore? Because mm-hmm. yeah. this is all I see now. This is the only thing I see when I look in the mirror, is this guy who can't stop taking these pills.
So how did you survive day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year, with this underlying knowledge that you're struggling, but everyone else is, business as usual? That to me would be kind of its own prison too. Like I wanna talk about this. I wanna get help. But each day, each week, each month, each year that you postpone that, it's like when this does come out, I'm gonna lose everything. Everyone's gonna walk away from me. Everybody's gonna, they're gonna leave me behind. Did that kind of thought process sneak in?
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's totally fear based. But I think a couple of things is that because I was this kid who grew up on like this pedestal of sports in my, small Nebraska. I mean, it's in Lincoln, but it's a small town. Yeah. And everybody knew who I was. And to think that I would have to come clean and let everybody know that I'm struggling with this was like, it was a huge hurdle. And we all overcome hurdles when we ask for help. But that was a huge hurdle for me. And the fact is I would spend for the good part of that decade, Blue, I laid in bed next to my wife and I was like, Corey, just say it. Say it, like it's on the tip of your tongue, say it. And I didn't, like, I mean, that's, it starts to take like every aspect of your life gets wrapped up in it. It starts to eat away so much of you and like how you think of yourself and your thoughts. And like, it just starts to eat you away. Yeah. And I wanted to say it so badly so many times, and I just couldn't do it. And I also had this feeling that if I could just say it, if I could say this out loud, this secret that I've been holding, like, that's what I need. I need somebody else to know, like,
right.
And yet it took me 10 years. It took me
Do you know why? Not looking back at it, what were you really concerned about? What were you really worried about that just couldn't get those words out that you needed help? And this was a situation. What was it that you kind of told yourself would happen if?
Yeah. You think that you will lose it all. The woman laying next to me, my wife, will walk because this isn't who she married. My job, my family, like my friends. And the funny thing about the friends and anything is, like, as you go down this path of addiction and abuse, like, you start to isolate yourself. I did.
Yeah.
You no longer have, the self-confidence, and you're not authentic. Therefore, it's really hard to be authentic with people and keep relationships going. Like, they were a facade, but they weren't real. Mm-hmm. And so I lost a lot of those relationships along the way. Maybe I kept in touch with them, but because they didn't know this about me. And this is the biggest thing in my life that I can't say to anybody. So I was worried about losing all of that. I mean, I think that's totally fear-based. And I think that as you keep playing these things in your head, you're like, how's it going to go? How could it go? It's always fear that wins, that this will, destroy my life. And for so long, I thought, if I could just stop, then nobody has to know, right? Like, I'm a high functioning addict. Nobody has to know if I can just quit, but I couldn't quit. And so I also liken that back to, when I was looking for examples of myself, I'm like, well, that's, there's examples. There's tons of people out there suffering in this gray area where I did, where I wasn't homeless and an addict on the street, and I wasn't the professional athlete or the celebrity who has a group of people helping him. I was in this gray area where I was functioning. And that's why I think I had such a hard time finding my stories, because if you recover and overcome, I don't have to share my story. And I don't mean to say that like pat on the back, but like I didn't. I told my wife, my brother, and that's what I needed. And I went to therapy, right? Like I didn't need to share this. But after 2 years and talking to my wife about like what this all meant and like how my story has to serve others. Like it can't be just like I did this and I beat opioids and I'm done. Like what's the meaning behind this? And I was like, I need to be that story. I need to be the one that like the people who are struggling and are high functioning and they're like, I have a problem, but man, I just can't admit it, or I don't want to admit it. And this is, you know, destroying me slowly. It's like, you're not alone. There's a lot of us out there that have struggled in that. And you have to ask for help. Like you have to ask 100%. For help.
So then how did it come for you then? Like, when was the cap from the bottle top popped off? I mean, when did you finally say, all right, I got to take a knee, time out, here we go.
What was it? So my wife and I were moving to Seattle from Nebraska. And I won't get into the backstory of that. We are adventurous. We have been all over the place. We have been very nomadic. We are adventurous. We had moved a lot of places. We had actually just the prior fall moved in 2017. We moved to Puerto Rico. We had saved money. We quit our jobs. Like from the outside, blue. So this is another hard thing. From the outside, for people who don't know us very well or look on social media and all those things, like, holy crap, man, these guys just have the life. They, you know, their life is just incredible. And that's another reason it's hard to ask for help, because once again, that's what people think of you.
You say, how did you do this? How are you doing this? And you're like, you've got a good question.
Yeah. Right. Gotcha. So anyways, we bought a sailboat. We were going to take a year off from work and we were going to have an adventure with our family and we were going to sail through the Caribbean. Amazing. Oh, right. It sounds like the dream come true.
Yeah.
It's life happens everywhere, right? You buy a boat in Puerto Rico, like your life doesn't stop. Yeah. My issues don't stop. My wife was suffering through postpartum depression at the time. I didn't know it. Like we were both like struggling through really hard things. Two hurricanes came through, destroyed the islands. Hurricane Irma and Maria came through and we evacuated and ended up back in my parents' basement in Nebraska trying to swerve and figure out what our life looks like.
Wow.
And so I found, I had a contact and I got a job up in the Seattle area and I moved out there with my brother, helps me, my younger brother by 10 years, helps me move a U-Haul truck to Seattle. And my wife and kids stay in Nebraska. We're going to get the house settled and then I'll fly back and get them and bring them out. And
we driving this U-Haul truck literally across country.
Cross country. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yep. And it was a bad time. I mean, that 3 month window where we left Puerto Rico and we were at home, like, sadly, like my dad had just had surgery. I had access to his pills. Like I was we were all in a bad place. We were just surviving. And this got to the point where I was, I started to get really nervous about the fact that I couldn't handle this anymore. I couldn't control my abuse anymore, my addiction anymore. It was taking control and I was getting really nervous about what that meant for my future. And so we moved to Seattle, we unpacked the truck. The next morning, I wake up early to go get a coffee for my brother and I, and I'm sitting in a parking lot waiting for it to open. And I break down and I'm just bawling in my car. And I'm like, I need help. Like I can't possibly ask my wife and kids to move out here when I'm an absolute mess and I need help. So I look up a opioid hotline number and I call it and a gentleman answers and I just blurt out, my name's Corey. I've been abusing opioids for the better part of a decade and I need help. Like I need somebody to help me.
Wow.
And it's the first time I ever said it out loud. And he says, where are you located? I told him where I was located. And he said, hey, we don't serve your area. I'm going to connect you with the people who do. And so he connects me and it's a deadline and nobody there. And so I say, I just found the strength to say this out loud to somebody. So I rush home and I wake my brother up, pull him out of bed. And I just vomit this all on him. You know, like
your younger brother,
my
too,
younger
right?
brother who had been looking at me. He's looked up at me since he was a kid. I mean, I've been his role model. And now I came to him and I was like, I need help, Casey. Like I've been abusing opioids for 10 years. Like I need help. And there was this huge relief to say it to somebody who loved me that I knew now I had accountability. Somebody knew, somebody in my life knew. But at the same time, there's this guilt of, I didn't tell my wife first. My wife is, I've been trying to tell her for so long. And she's not the first person I told. So there was some guilt involved in that. And now we can look back on that, my wife and I, and be like, it didn't matter. Like, it, he was there for a reason. Like, he was a person that needed to hear it, that was there for me. And so I'm not a big believer in, like, it all happens for a reason necessarily, but I no longer carry that guilt or shame of, like, I didn't tell my wife, because at the end of the day, the thing that needed to happen was I needed to ask for help. That's all.
Right.
That's it.
Oh, man. Incredible.
So. Yeah. So, go ahead.
I mean, because here you are dumping this on him. He's probably like you, like, well, can we call a hotline? You're like, I've already tried that, man. Like, I mean, what came next after your
brother? You know, because he's my brother and he doesn't think there could possibly be anything wrong with me, he tries to normalize it too for me, right? He tries to be like, Corey, you're not the only one who would, you know, take a pill here and there and do this. And I was like, Casey, it almost was like the best thing ever. Like, I had to convince him that this was a big deal and I needed help, right? Like, it was almost like he forced me to admit, like, dark things that I hadn't, you know, said or told anyone, about me stealing my dog's medication, about me stealing his, you know, my dog's fentanyl patch, stealing drugs from, you know, people. Like, it made me, like, be the prosecutor of my own habit and my own addiction.
I can only imagine you trying to convince you, like him, that no, I really do have a problem. He's like, yeah, but no, but listening slowly but surely, he's probably like, oh my gosh, he's telling the truth.
Yeah. And, dang, you know, 5 years prior to that, Blue, I had been on opioids for a while for a back issue. And I went into a doctor who I was seeing, and I told him, hey man, this was my call for help. That was, it fell on deaf ears, and I kind of felt like I tried. Right. And so, like, 5 years prior to that, I went in and I just said, hey, you guys have been prescribing me these, and I just don't feel good. I'm worried about, like, the addiction side of things. Like, I just said that. And because I was abusing them. Like, I was abusing them. And I thought, if I just voice, like, hey, I'm kind of nervous about this, then this will tip them off and help. Yeah. Like I wasn't honest enough to say, like, man, guys, I need help. But I was like, if I just tell them that I'm worried, like, maybe that'll be enough. And it was kind of just pushed to the side of, like, no, you're okay. Like, these things aren't that addictive. Like, you seem to be doing fine. And I'm like,
you seem to be doing fine. And right? They look at your background. They know who you are. And they're like, yeah, you're an athletic guy. You've got these, you know, you've got a great job. Like, you'll be fine. You got enough people around you, but you're like, ah, oh, dang, dude, I wonder if that happens. I wonder if that happens more often than we think, where people try and drop these subtle hints, but because they're not comfortable about saying, I'm an addict, because, I mean, like it or not, there's still pain there that needs to be medicated to a certain degree. Does that make sense? And so the fear of all that, my question for you is, when you finally started getting off of it, was your back as bad as you remember?
No.
Because I remember talking to a client of mine years ago, and I'm like, dude, you've been on these pain medications for 5 years. And I'm like, I'll bet you don't even remember what your back even feels like. He's like, no, it's going to be so bad. And when he weaned him, when he got himself off and had some time, he came to me and he's like, you know what? It's minimal compared to what I thought it was going to be. That thought of the pain was so big compared to the small part that it was. He's like, I can do this through other ways to help me heal. But is that what happened to you too? Or, I mean, because you have legitimate pain, but
you know what though, like, you do, but for me, in my experience, like, it was here and there. I would have episodes here and there. If I picked something up heavy and turned wrong, right? And that would last a short amount of time. I used it. I knew that I was using it as a crutch to get these pills. Gotcha. And sadly also, I can look back and say that, you know, they say, hey, strengthen your core. Like, I've always been an athlete. I've always been, you know, in fairly good shape, but I would kind of take that, like, I'm in pretty good shape. Like, you know, I needed to have that crutch. Like, I used it that way. Like, I wasn't lying to myself. I knew that I didn't need these pills all the time for the physical pain. I was using them to mask the other, you know, things in my life that I hadn't worked through, the things that were voids that I was filling with these drugs to mask that
for
pain.
For sure.
So
how did you end up getting help? Because I'm sure trying to convince people you need help, and then sitting down with your wife, I mean, how
my brother
was
the only one I had to convince. Say that. And that's all because you know, like, he looked up to me so much. I think he didn't want to believe it either. He didn't want to have to believe that. And so I told him, I was flying back the next day to Nebraska to get my wife and kids, and I told Casey, my brother, I said, hey, I'm when I get back there, if I haven't texted you by 9 p.m. and tell you that I'm talking to Nikki, then you need to call Nikki and say Corey has something to tell you. I needed a backstop. I needed.
Holy cow!
I needed him to keep me accountable because I'd wanted to say it for so many times and I couldn't do it. And I was like, I need that to happen. This has to happen. So you have to call her.
Very rare that someone can hold themselves accountable to that level, Corey. That blows my mind. And I'm like wicked proud that you did that because there's always that doubt of like, ooh, what did I just do? You know, but you made it. So like, there is no escape. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing. You, like you said, you created that backstop. The ball is going to stop there. You know, and I need the accountability. I need the backup. That yeah. blows my mind. How did you even think of that? I'm so curious.
Well, I think it's the fact that I had never said it out loud, and I finally did. Like, you know, I finally admitted to somebody, and I felt like this has to be the moment. Like, this has to be when it changes. Like I can't. I'm exhausted from hiding this. I'm exhausted from looking at myself like this. Like, this has to be the time it changed. Like, I just said it out loud to somebody that loves me. Like, this. There can't be going back now.
How much courage was involved in that? Because, you know, I look at that same kind of like, you know, like you said, the backstop, everything there, getting ready to catch it in case you miss it. But like the same as you, you know, walking into the batter's box, you know, getting up there and, you know, into position, knocking the dirt off your cleats, you know, staring down the barrel of the pitcher, you know, to the pitcher's mound. And you're like, I have to swing. Like, yeah. I can't just stand here. I got to swing. And that's kind of the same concept of like, okay, I'm back in the box. Like I got a swing and here it comes. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I think that my baseball background, you know, in so many ways it hurt me because of how wrapped up I was and who I, and not being who I was, but in yeah. so many ways, like being a high level athlete also provides a, accountability. And like you've built over time, like you practice so hard, you work so hard, like that, like you're used to doing hard things. Like you're used to doing hard things, whether it's physically or mentally, like as a professional athlete, like you're used to doing hard things. And this was the hardest thing. But the moment I said it, it was kind of like, well, you're in the game now, so you just got to go. Like you have to run with it, right? Like, what do you do now? You can't ask to, you know, sub me out. Like that's not how it works.
Pinch hitter, like nope.
Yeah. Can't. And deep down, man, like I wanted that help. You know, like I did. Like I didn't know how to ask for it for so long, but I wanted it. Like I was so exhausted of living that lie. You know, and sadly, like, you know, I thought to myself on multiple occasions, like, what do I want more? Like, could I be clean? And what would my life look like? Who would leave me? Like how bad would it be? Besides being clean, what other things would fall? Yeah. Or would I be better off if I just had a lifetime supply of these things and I could just numb my pain for the rest of my life? And then nobody knows, like, could I keep it a secret that long? And that's a crazy thing to think that's my, like my two options. But, but when you're deep in something, like nothing seems like a good option.
No. Everything seems like a dead end.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, you flew back and you walk into your place and there's your wife sitting there. I mean, how did you approach that?
Yeah, so I flew in, my wife picks me up. We have our kids in the car at that time. They're 3 and 1. And I can't have that conversation then. Like, A, I don't want to have it in front of my kids at that point. Right. And two is like, anybody who has kids, like you can't have conversations, right? Like,
yeah.
And they're going to be interrupted in a heartbeat.
They're excited, like, to just, see you too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You can't have that conversation. So I tried my best to be as normal as possible coming off of an airplane ride where I just bawled the entire time thinking that this was the end of my marriage. This is the end of, you know, the life as I know it and what the repercussions might be. And I was kind of prepared for the worst. I was prepared for the worst, but I couldn't even fathom what the worst was. I kept, you know, this will be the end of everything of the good stuff in my life. And so we put the kids to bed and I go in and I say, Nikki, I have something to tell you. And I don't know how to say it. Like, you don't have words for these things. You don't know how to say these things. And so I'm sitting there stuttering and she's like, you know, fucking tell me, Corey. Sorry. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're fine. Yeah.
Fucking tell me, Corey, what's going on? And I'm bawling and she's like, do you have cancer? Like, what's happening?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I've been struggling with opioid addiction for 10 years and you don't know about it. And I was like, and I need you to know. And it still makes me emotional to talk about because it's, That was the biggest moment of my life, right? Like, I mean, there's been huge things. I've been, you know, been married and had kids, but like this one thing has changed my life more than anything else in my life.
Yeah, man.
And so that started, you know.
I can just see you got full count, man. Either you're going to strike out or you're going to be able to go.
Yeah.
And you're like, it all comes down to this. And I can see her now catastrophizing just as you've done to the worst possible solution. She's like, you got cancer? Like, have you been unfaithful? I mean, there's so many things she probably went to before she even thought of addiction.
Oh, it wouldn't have been, it wasn't on her radar, right? Like, the only reason it's so hard is because of who I was and how I was known, even to my wife, was like, this couldn't possibly be something that Corey struggled with. And so, you know, so
she something though. She felt something. She had to have, when you were saying, when you said those words, I'm addicted to opiates.
You know, there's this huge weight that's lifted off of my shoulders in all of this. The moment I tell my brother, the moment I tell my wife, there's a weight lifted off of me because now it's not my secret. It's not my own, my cross to carry. Like other people know, but at the same time, like I've just placed that now on these other people in my life. Like my wife now has to carry this heavy, heavy burden of knowing this about me. And, you know, there is sadness, there's frustration, there's anger, there's love, you know, there's all of these things that are going on in this 5 hours of us talking before we, you know, eventually fall asleep of just pure exhaustion. And the next day she says, you know, I can't move to Seattle with you without, you know, I need to go talk to somebody. Like, we need to talk to a therapist, a professional. Like, I need to understand this more. And I was like, I do too. And I was like, I will do anything. Like, I will do anything, right, to get help and to make our lives whole again, or to mend this, right? Like I am on board for wherever this takes. So we had a family friend who's a therapist, and we were able to get in on a Sunday and spend, you know, 2 hours talking about this and setting a plan in place. And like, what's my responsibility in this? How do I get help? Nikki, what's your responsibility? Like, what do you need? And like this, Corey getting help is not your burden. Like you can hold him accountable to this, and you know he needs to know that there are you know, if he doesn't stay the path, that like
there'll be consequences.
There's consequences. Yes, thanks for the word I couldn't come up with. But yeah, but there's consequences to this, and it's not for her to carry, it's for me to go out and prove. And so
that's a ton of a personal accountability. Like, that's so rare. But I think it kind of reflects the fact that you were done. You're like, I'm done. And I say this a lot, like, you got to be all the way out before you can get all the way back in. And it's kind of like you were just about all the way out of life before this, you know, an addiction was just about ready to stranglehold you.
Yeah.
And then you jump back in. And that blows my mind. The level of personal accountability is off the charts, Corey. That's not usually how it works, man. Like, usually it's because you've been discovered or you've been pulled over by the cops or something. Like, your willingness to throw up that flag to surrender it's mind-boggling to me, because your story you're right. It's not cut of the mill. It's not run of the mill. It's very unique in that you took a knee and you're like, I'm done. And in order to do that, I got to get all the way out of this addiction. Yeah. That blows my mind. Do you recognize? I mean, I don't know how much you work with people in addiction recovery, but people don't do that, Corey. They don't sacrifice the thing that's kept them going for so long. I'm just so intrigued about, you know.
Well, you know, so that aspect. So two things to that is, one is my wife and I just had this conversation the other night. The fact that it wasn't being found out. I had talked to somebody in another podcast who, you know, faced a lot of judgment and when they came, you know, and asked for help, and how even their significant other, like, basically threw them under the bus. And the person was like, in a similar situation as me, was like, they weren't caught. They just needed help. They came and asked for help, and they were met in a different way than I was. And that, you know, everybody's relationships and stuff are different. Yeah. So you can't speak to that, but thank you for that, because it is true. Like, normally people are caught. Normally there's something that forces somebody to maybe not even ask for help, but forced to get help. And in my situation, it was, I have to be done with this. Like, I came to get help before it destroyed me, before everybody found out about it. I just had to be done with it.
I think you're pretty optimistic about people finding out, because again, 10 years, man, under the radar. Like, me, it blows my mind. But that's the thing, right? And we talk about that. And it's unfortunate the person that you spoke to had that situation, because it takes an incredible amount of courage to do what you've done and to continue to do it. And when you start seeking services and start seeking help, you start realizing that your story, like you just said, has the potential to change lives. And we talk about this, you know, you'll hear at the end of the podcast, the thing that we do to sign off is turn your mess into a message. It's interesting because to a certain degree, that's what you felt like called to do, is to like say, what about the person who doesn't get caught, but just doesn't like the way life's going? Because again, your story is so unique that it's unwritten. No one talks about Blue,
let's think about that, right? Like mine is rare, but I am convinced that it's only rare because it's not out there, because there's people who are struggling and not 100%, talking about it.
Like 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that rare. I think that there's a huge, huge group of people who are in the shoes that I had been in for so long that don't know what to do. And their stories aren't out there because their stories, A, don't have to be out there. And B, like there's not many people who ask for help at that point. Sometimes it progresses to the point where they get caught, they get found out, something really bad in their life happens. But like, man, if nothing else, like if you're there, if you're in that moment where I was, like, just ask, say it. Like the times it was on the tip of my tongue, like I could have saved myself, you know, years of struggling and shame had I asked then. But I don't dwell on that anymore. Now I'm like, you just need to ask, you need to say it out loud, and it will progress. It will progress. Addiction, it progresses. So even if you're managing and you're high functioning, it progresses. I am, my mind progressed the same way until the point I was stealing meds from everybody. And I was, you know, having, you know, times when I felt like I was overdosing and my breathing would slow down. Like I thought I was going to die a few times. Right. So it's not just this slow process of, it was kind of bad here and there. Like it progresses to the point where there's no discrimination and these things will take your life.
Which is interesting because I think it shows that ultimate, sense of love that you have for not just yourself, but for your family, because, you know, that would have been a horrible story. And it all been scratching their heads as to what happened. We thought that, you know, and so I'm amazed by that. As you started that healing process into recovery, why in the world engage yourself into a sport by which you could recreate injury? I mean, you know, from ball player to addiction to now Ironman, that's a hefty gap to clear. Like, what did that mean to you to take that next step into getting back into the competitive part? Because that's what we do on Team Addict Athlete.
Yeah.
If you're an addict and you move to an athlete, that's all just a progression. The further you get away by adding more attributes, so like athlete and then father and then brother and then, you know, husband, all these things, you get further away from the addiction. It's like a thing to build on. That's a huge gap. Like, yeah. What in the world?
So this is the good stuff, man. This is the good stuff to talk about, right? Yeah. This is what it's all led to, because, you know, the moment that you beat your addiction, you feel as though, I mean, I had this almost the moment I said it out loud. The moment that I like felt like I had the courage to say it out loud, I felt like more power than I'd ever had in my life. Absolutely. And I also felt like there is nothing I cannot do. Like, if I just came clean about this secret that I've had for a decade, if I just came clean and I'm going to beat this and I have beaten it, like, you know, through that whole time, I'm like, there's nothing I can't do, especially physically. Like, you know, that is all a mental, that struggle was so mental with the shame and the guilt and all those things. And I felt like, okay, if I can come through that, then there's nothing I can't do. And what is the most like badass thing that you can do? I remember watching the World Championships of Ironman on TV and thinking to myself, you know, you hear all these stories of inspiration and you're just like, A, you're in awe. I remember this was probably 2010 watching it and just being like, holy crap, these people are amazing, incredible. Like, what's my excuse to not be able to do something like this? And I look back,
Al Bradwig, like commentating, and he's giving these little spurs off of people, and you're like, wait a minute, if they can do it, maybe I can.
Yeah, you have that. It's like planted there, like maybe I could, but like at that point, A, it seems so far-fetched. Just because of purely the race itself, you know, you're not talking about any of the mental side of it, just like the miles in itself. You're like, holy crap, that just seems like not humanly possible. But then, like, I was watching that and I'm sitting there, you know, that's like the beginning stages of my addiction. And like, I had other things going on like that, like I wasn't there. Like that's, I didn't think I was capable because I thought way less of myself for that time.
Yeah.
And my self-confidence was, you know, way, way down. And all those things, like when you're in addiction or you're, you know, in that phase of your life, there's so many things you don't think you're A, capable of, or B, deserving of.
100%.
And so, so the moment that I came clean, and it wasn't the moment that I came clean. The moment that I told my wife, I did feel like, holy crap, if we can get through this, like we can get through anything. And probably it was a year later, my wife and I had taken a weekend away, which we try to do now, to just set goals and connect and just like not have the kids there so we can have, you know, real conversations about what we want from our life and that kind of thing, which are conversations we never had at that, those 10 years, right? Like I was never looking that far ahead because I was in my own place.
You didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I tell my wife, I say, hey, we're talking about goals. And I say, the first thing that I wanted to talk about is like, I'm an Ironman. I was like, I'm going to say it as if I've done it, but I'm going to be an Ironman. And my wife is like, hell yes. Like, do it. And I was like, no, I'm going to go to the hotel room and find a race on the computer and sign up. And like, I'm just like, I don't know like much about it, but I'm going to do it. And so I went up to the room and I found an Ironman in Texas. And I was like, boop, boop, boop. You know, there's my freaking $1,000 to pay you to go do this crazy race.
But yeah, you drop $1,000 on a race, you're going to follow through and do it. That's
But that was the beginning, Blue, of like this, of how I started to really understand beyond every day I would tell my wife, I choose us. That was like my way of telling her that like, I will not go back to opioids, that like, I choose us over anything else. Like you and the kids is what I choose. And that was like the beginning of keeping promises on a daily basis, because that's what recovery is, right? Is promising yourself you're never going to go back to what you were doing before that addiction. And then I found a plan for Ironman, and it was important for me at this point that I was going to do this on my own, right? Because for so long, I couldn't keep promises to myself. Every day I would pop a pill. It was me breaking my promises. And I felt like when I do this amazing thing, when I finish this Ironman, it will be because I did it myself. I didn't have anybody holding me accountable. This is proof to myself that if I set a goal and keep my promises daily, that like I can achieve pretty freaking amazing things.
You against yourself. I love that, man.
It has nothing to do. I think Ironman a lot, or any of these endurance races, it doesn't have much about the podium for most people. It has like to do with like proving something to yourself.
That's why I love it. That's why it works on Team Addict Athlete. When these folks who don't believe they can even run around the block, train and literally become athletes, they sign up for these 5Ks, 10Ks, halves, and full marathons, ultra marathons, and they complete it. They're still kind of blown away. Like, I did that. You had it in you the whole time.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of commitment and hard work. And you've done that in the past. What was it like reawakening some of that athlete that was still inside you to like get up and go swimming and to get on the bike and to go running? I mean, come on, right?
Yeah.
Baseball,
you know, we're not full of a ton of like, you know, stellar athletes. We're more skilled people for the most part, right? So, you know, short sprints and stuff like that. So I wasn't built to necessarily go out and do this, but I was athletic enough and I knew. And once again, you see the stories of people who do Ironmans and you're like, there's no excuse for me not to be able to do this.
Exactly.
But day in and day out, man, the cool thing about setting a physical fitness goal is the fact that A, it's so mental. It's so mental. But B is when you do these things, when you finish a workout, A, you get the feelings, the endorphins, the stuff that makes you feel good about yourself. You get that. That's a byproduct of it.
Yep.
The second thing you get is anytime you run further than you did before, you're like, holy shit, I'm a badass. I can't believe I just did that. Uh-huh. I can't believe I just did that. And when you're training for a big race or anything that you're training for, and you continue to progress and get more and more miles, more and more time, every day that happens, you are keeping a promise, you're building your confidence, and you're like, holy shit, man, I am doing stuff that I never thought I could do. I remember running like a half marathon after work one day at the track by myself and thinking, I mean, I'm freaking, you know, got my headphones and I'm just like, hell yes. Like, text my wife, I'm like, I'm a badass. Like, I'm a badass. You want to know what I just did? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. And so it just became this thing where there was something really cool about the fact that I didn't have to meet anybody. I didn't need to meet anybody at the pool. I didn't need to meet anybody at the track. Like, I was being accountable to myself for the first time in a long time. And that's what got me from, you know, my first day of training, running 2 miles and thinking my knees were going to explode to finishing Ironman Florida in, you know, last November. and doing the entire race just with feeling like grateful the entire time. People asked me like what it felt like, and I was like, I felt grateful. It was the only Ironman, full Ironman that happened last year. So I felt grateful the fact that I could even go, right? Yeah. And there's, you know, there's the pandemic going on, and my wife and I are like, if it goes, I'm going. Like, you have to take, you know, there's risks out there in the world. And I was like, absolutely. This is one that I will absolutely take a risk on, and I will travel to Florida to do this race if it's on. And the fact that it happened, I was so grateful to be just standing there on the beach. And somebody had gave me some great advice at the race before I was, you know, last checking, and they're like, this is like the victory lap, man. Like, you've done how many, you know, miles and miles of training, like, just enjoy it. And so that just sunk in, and I just felt like I'm so grateful to be here. And also, in what you got, you know, running marathons, running anything, that any, everybody's hard thing is their hard thing. You can't compare it to somebody else's. Like, just because somebody did a half Ironman or a marathon and you're doing a 10K, well, your 10K may be just as badass as that person's marathon, because we're all like progressing and everything, you know, there's different levels of hard for different people. And so you can't compare it. You cannot compare it.
You are so speaking our language. I mean, it's perfectly aligned with what I saw when, you know, 10 years ago this weekend, Addict Athlete turns 10. And 10 years ago, I'm like, all we have in my area is 12-step groups. And I'm like, there's got to be something else out there, because some of it doesn't work for some people. Yeah. And I know for me, I got clean, you know, by mountain biking and running and doing things. And so I'm like, I wonder if we can recreate something like that. So I took five people, started them on this journey. 10 years later, we've got hundreds of athletes now. You're speaking that common truth. And you and I have never spoke before, but you're speaking the language that works for these folks. It's like they overcome this stuff. And I'm curious, there had to have been a hard part in the middle of that race where you're like, man, this kind of hurts. This sucks, but I'm going to keep doing it. What part was uncomfortable? What part kind of hurt? I'm curious. Yeah.
So Man Blue, what I wanted from this race was it to be the hardest thing that I've ever done, right? Like there was something about this coming full circle that what I overcame, and now to be, makes me emotional just to think about Mike Riley saying Corey Harrington, Ironman, that I wanted it to be so freaking hard. I wanted it to bury me, but for me to keep going. Like, I was like, it does not matter what happens to me in this race. I will not stop, and I will finish on the course. I will finish this race. And there's a huge part of me that was like, don't be easy. Not that an Ironman can possibly be easy, but I was like, make me work for this. Like, I know I've put in the hours and the time and all the training, but man, I want this to just bring me to my knees. And to prove to myself that even when I'm in that low point, that I can continue to go, because I made a promise. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, on the bike, towards the second half of the bike, I wasn't doing a good job. I wasn't doing a good job of hydrating. And honestly, part of doing an Ironman and doing it by yourself without a coach or a group of anything is like, you're kind of doing it on the fly, and you probably skimp on some things that you probably should pay more attention to. And nutrition was one of those things that I just didn't have dialed in, but I was like,
it's one of the biggest issues.
Right. But, but I'm struggling. I'm cramping. Like my legs are cramping. I'm getting off the bike about every 10 miles because I'm seizing up. And I'm all I eat is bananas on the bike route because I can't eat anything else. And I'm like, bananas, the potassium maybe will help my cramps. And I'm just drinking water and potassium, taking salt, and just trying to get rid of these cramps. And it crosses my mind as I'm going through this. And I had seized up like six times. And every time I get on, like I can't fully extend before it seizes. And I'm like, how in the hell am I going to finish the bike? But then I got to do the marathon after this.
Marathon after this. Yeah.
But like those moments that would happen, like when I would think that, I was like, it doesn't matter, man. Like, you can just keep going. Like, you can keep going. If you have to crawl for a while, you crawl for a while. Like, absolutely, you will get through this. And so I think in my old Corey before coming clean in recovery, would have saw many things on that, in that race, as a sign to just stop.
Right.
And what I saw being out there in my experience was those things that I would have seen as a sign to stop were signs of be a badass, like do what you promise yourself to do, and you will do not stop. And I actually, it never crossed my mind to, it really didn't. Like, I mean, I was like, there's no way I did all this and I will not stop, because the first time I shared my story, Blue, that I actually publicly said, like, this has been my struggle and this is my why for this race, was in a Facebook group with athletes that are getting involved in that, or they were going to run that race. And
how many of them said, hey, Oh, by the way, me too.
I mean, the community is huge, right? The Ironman community is huge. B, like, you're not alone. Anybody who's out there struggling, you are so freaking not alone. And people want to connect with you, and you will be somebody else's reason for hope and joy, just like somebody else was the reason for yours.
100%, brother.
And
the reason why I ask you about that hard part in the middle there, you know, there's a few reasons. One, because I'm a firm believer that the hard parts always come in the middle of our stories. It never comes at the end, right? And so if we're experiencing a hard part, it's because our story's not over yet. But more so, as bad as those cramps were, as much as that sucked and it hurt, it didn't even hold a candle to the pain that you felt flying back home, getting ready to tell your wife, or you know, like you know, getting your brother involved and telling him that story. I mean, that was real pain. So it's like, that's why I think it makes such amazing athletes, is because they've dealt with some heavy stuff in life, some real pain. So that pain of them getting cramps running up the mountain or on the bike or in the pool, it's like, it hurts, but it doesn't compare to anything I've already been through. We've suffered enough. This is tolerable.
Blue, I wrote this post the other day on my Instagram account, and I finished it with the strength that it took for us to survive is the strength that it takes to thrive. And it is like the truth, what you just said, like finishing this race or the physical pain that I'm going through doesn't hold a candle to the desperation, the sadness, the anguish, like all of those things that you feel in addiction, like those things, if you overcome those, that's why you can do an Ironman. I don't care who you are out there. You get out to that community, you can do a freaking Ironman. All it is, it's mental willpower to do it. It's incredible.
You know, I love this. Listeners, I hope you're paying attention to the passion that Corey's got here, because he's speaking the truth, and everyone can do this. It just may take some people a little longer, maybe a little faster, but it's possible if you determine, you make up your mind that you really want it. And I think sometimes we fail to even, I guess, appreciate some of those goals we set, because it's like, well, do I deserve it? You know, I want this, but do I deserve it? It's like, get out there and create it. Get out there and just start going. It blows my mind. I mean, I've followed you now for a couple of weeks, and I've been reading some of your posts and stuff, and I love the fact that you're very much aware that it's not easy, but it's worth it if you'll ask for help. I love that more than anything, Corey, that you were not afraid at the very end to say, I need help, because like you said, that's what keeps people sick.
Yeah.
I'm curious though, as we've kind of, you know, these hours go by quick, man. What's on the horizon for you? What is the next thing that's coming down the pipeline that you're looking forward to, that you're kind of hoping you can be a part of?
Well, so I think that one thing is, especially it resonates in what you do and what we're talking about today, is as you get involved in these things and in these races and realize what you're capable of, it's a metaphor for so much more than just doing a race. Like you become aware that you're capable of so much more than you thought you were or deserving of. But you also, when you finish that 10K, you realize that all of a sudden that's your baseline. Like the person you never thought you'd run a 10K, now you ran a 10K. That's where you belong now. Now what's the next step above that? And like, you realize you've kind of lifted yourself up, that like your normal now is like, my normal is like, I feel normal in a group of Ironman, you know, race. Like,
would you ever have thought that?
Mm-hmm. Never would have thought that. But now I'm like, so what else can I do? Like that has to be like, that will propel me to the next thing that I want to do. And not that it has to be physical. I will be doing like a half Ironman in the fall, and Ironman will be a way of life, because it means so much to me now, because it brought my story full circle for me, and it's just who I am now.
Yeah. See, that's the beauty of it though. When you hit that finish line in Florida and you heard it over the PA system, you know, Corey Harrington, you are an Ironman. You kind of already knew it, but didn't it feel good to have someone else say it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it just sticks, right? It just like, it hit me in my heart. Like I was so freaking happy. Like there's a video of me crossing the line, and anybody who's seen it was like, dude, you don't even look like you're tired. And I was like, you have no idea how elated I was to be at that moment. Like anything that hurt did not matter. Like this, finishing that race is what mattered, because it was the culmination of me keeping all these promises to myself. And now I was like, so now what's my next thing? What is it that I can do next? Because there's not much I don't think I'm capable of at this moment. And, and you know, and so where I'm going with this, I guess, Blue, is I want my message to be heard, because I think it's important. I think that I couldn't find my story, and I want my story to be somebody else's reason for hope. And I think that my story can help the people in that way. And I think that the kind of the funny thing, Blue, is anybody who's been in our shoes, the thing that you kept a secret for so long, the thing you're so ashamed of, ironically, has become the thing that, like, I'm the most proud of. The thing that I want to go out and talk about, the thing I want to tell people about. I mean, it's almost this crazy, like, 180 of how is that even possible? Because for so long, you didn't want anybody to know this about you, and you hid it from everybody. And now it's the thing that has given me purpose, and the thing that, like, I want to go out and share that message, because I think we all struggle to figure out maybe what it is in our life that is, like, our passion. Mm-hmm. And when you go through something like this, you realize, I think, pretty quickly that that you're freaking incredible. If you've come through on the other side, or if you've asked for help, you're freaking incredible. And people who haven't gone through it won't even understand the strength that it takes to do it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, again, spoken from a champion of itself, Corey, I think that you will impact more lives doing what you're doing now than you ever would have in the major league. I really do. I think that this is your true calling. I mean, I can feel the passion. I'm there getting cold chills. My wife's over in the corner, like, holding up a sign. It's like, yeah, beautiful. He's right. Spot on. And I'm like, I hear it, man. How do people follow you? What social medias do you post? Like you said, you post some great stuff, and I know our athletes are going to want to follow you. What's the best platforms and ways to kind of?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm a little bit new to all this because I just decided to start sharing my story not that long ago. But I'm on Instagram at Corey Harrington Anew. And you can find me on Facebook at Corey Harrington as well. I'm working on a website just to be able to have a landing page to kind of put some information that I think is helpful. But at the end of the day, I'm just using those platforms to share bits of my story in the most honest and authentic way possible, in the hopes that, you know, I don't know. You never know who's struggling. You never know. Yeah. And so somebody needs to hear it. And whether that's that person or their friend or family, and it's shared with the right person at the right time, like, I just want to continue to put that out there, because it's important that we do that, and that we help people who are looking for help.
You're spot on. And it will be a listener, I know, that catches this podcast that will feel that message. Corey, thank you. Listeners, you've been well fed. Follow Corey. Get to know his story. Share this podcast with someone that you know you've been thinking about, or you've been worried about. Everyone has someone in their family that struggles with some kind of addiction. That's how prevalent it is. So getting this into the ears of those who may not be ready to ask for help, it could be that small push that gets them to that spot where they're willing to ask. And so,
and it may be that person that you don't think is the one that needs it to hear it.
Absolutely.
Know, it may be the one that you'd have no clue.
Absolutely. You've been well fed. I want to thank Corey for hanging out with us today. We'll have to have him back on, because I know this will be a good podcast. People want him back on. And I want to thank Radio Ronan and the Radio Ronan Network for hosting Team Addict to Athlete on the Radio Ronan platform. Josh Chandler, Spence and Chunga, thank you guys so much. And athletes, until next time, go turn that mess into a message. Okay.